Hello and welcome to I Am The Egg Pods with me, Chris Shaw. Throughout January 2022, a potpourri of delicious guests taking a jaunty stroll through Peter Jackson's Get Back, day by day, every day, on the day. In this episode, it's welcome return to author, host of No Such Thing as a Fish, and QI Elf, Dan Schreiber. Hello.
Hey, Chris. This is exciting.
It is. I hope it is.
I think it is. I mean, God, what an incredible gift we were given by Peter Jackson in this. I can't wait to hear all the previous episodes before me and what's going to come after, because I've, in the background, been speaking to a lot of Beatle friends, some of who I imagine are going to be on your series here, like Joel Morris and stuff like that. There's just so much to dissect, isn't there? It's wonderful.
It is. So let's jump straight in. So it's Tuesday the 14th of January. It's day 9 and we still haven't got George.
Yeah.
George isn't there.
Yeah.
There seems to be a strange atmosphere throughout all of this time, really.
Yeah, it's bizarre, isn't it? The day that he... You will have covered this in your just previous episode, but it's obviously this weird moment where they all go back into the studio and they almost seem as if they're completely loopy. They're doing... You know, Yoko's suddenly in the band, George is going wild, John's going wild. It's a bizarre moment. And actually, I was reading George Harrison's I Me Mine book the other day, and there's this whole section of it where it's all the lyrics that he writes, and he gives a bit of a story behind it. And I just happened to be reading Wawa, which appears on All Things Must Pass. So I don't know if this has been mentioned on the show in the previous episode, but he wrote that on the day that he got home after quitting the Beatles. And so he writes about it. So it's worth reading, because this is sort of like, this is behind the scenes of the documentary. Mm. But he says, Wawa was written during the Let It Be fiasco, which began with the rehearsal of the songs and ended up as the movie Let It Be. We'd been away from each other after having a very difficult time recording the White Album. That double album was so long, it went on forever, and there were all kinds of other bullshit things happening in the band. Pressures and problems, and after that we came back from a holiday and went straight into the old routine. It is that concept of how everybody sees and treats everybody else, allowing no consideration for the fact that we are changing all the time. I remember Paul and I were trying to have an argument, and the crew carried on filming and recording us. Anyway, after one of those first mornings, I couldn't stand it. I decided, this is it. It's not fun anymore. It's unhappy being in this band. It's very unhappy being in this band. It's a lot of crap. Thank you, I'm leaving. Wawa was a headache, as well as a foot pedal. It was written during the time in the film where John and Yoko were freaking out, screaming. I'd left the band, gone home, and wrote this tune. So that's what George was doing in these days. We got the song Wawa, which is a wonderful song.
It is, yeah.
So,
What a thing. They're just desperate to get him back. It's weird, though. There's a couple of different versions, having spoken about it, where they keep mentioning the word strike. George is on strike, rather than he's left the band. So from his perspective, he seems to think, yeah, right, I've quit. Mm. But they're kind of, nah, he's just on strike.
Well, which I find... What was the chat that happens immediately after between him and Mal, where they're talking about, we'll sort out residuals and we'll sort out... Like, Mal's immediately jumped into, cool, let me organise the money situation now. I don't know, that was such a bizarre... I mean, obviously, we must have missed out on a bunch of conversation that led to that. Mal didn't just jump in with that, but... It was sort of them just trying to take it serious. And then, as you say, this probably happened a bunch of times with them. But, and obviously it happened with Ringo before. But what a moment. Again, I know where this is almost preamble just for the context of this day that we're talking about. But what an extraordinary thing to have caught that exact moment on camera where George says, just very casually, I think that's it. I think I'll leave the band now. It's quite extraordinary. And then, you know, this day opening with Paul, what a great chat the opening chat of this is, regardless of anything to do with the politics of the band at this point. Just, what's the clapper loader? Paul Bond sitting there, isn't it? And Paul is just basically explaining music theory to him while playing a song, which is just wonderful. This whole thing of going once, and he says that line, it's really lovely, where he says, every song in the world is contained within these notes here sitting in front of us on the piano. It's such a beautiful image. You've just got to find them. You've just got to put them in together in new different ways. And once you know how things work, you can see what other people are doing in their songs. And And piano players, I find more than guitar players or any other instrument, talk about the instruments and songs like that. Tim Minchin once said that to me as well. He just said, I can do whatever you need to happen. Do you want to feel really touched? I can do that in an instinct because I know the chords that will do that. So let me do that for you right now. Kind of, you know, it's, I think Paul looks at it slightly like that as well, to an extent.
Yeah. And Paul Bond's face, he's just absolutely chuffed to bits, isn't he?
Unbelievable, yeah. What a thing. But also, in the face of such a chaotic... Everyone had to be going into work that day going, the fuck is going to happen today? This is insane. George has left. They're still coming in. What, are they going to continue as a three? There's been a few jokes about get Clapton in and so on. And, you know, what are we witnessing here? It must have been very bizarre. And so... Yeah, I mean, Paul Bond got a front seat to a very bizarre day.
There's a few songs that ad-libbed throughout all of the three parts of this. And for some reason, this has been given a title, and they've called it Bonding, and it's credited to Lennon McCartney. So I don't know who's coming up with these names, because it's just ad-libbed chords.
I wonder, because obviously the surviving Beatles, they were part of the process to an extent. They had... probably Peter Jackson on the end of a phone. I wonder if he... Because you can't just name a Beatles jam and... like, Peter Jackson can't just do that, right? Remember that letter that appeared in the anthology book, I think it was, where Paul McCartney wrote to Phil Spector because Phil Spector did the dirty of adding orchestra and all, did whatever he wanted to the Let It Be album. And it's a furious letter from Paul just saying, we're the Beatles. Don't touch anything of our... Don't put a creative decision without us having decided on this. And I think, yeah, unless Paul was going through each of these little jams going, I think I'll call that one Bonding, or, you know, someone in the studio is naming Beatles songs on their behalf. And it's interesting, isn't it? We always have this big dilemma of who wrote the Beatles tunes, you know the Lennon-McCartney thing, and everyone's always been giving McCartney crap about the fact that he's trying to flip the credit and he's trying to say, you know, this is just mine. I really felt this documentary really sort of played a part in vindicating him, because you're just watching him create these songs, and then suddenly when you see that Lennon-McCartney come up underneath, you think, oh yeah, Lennon's been given a very big role in this song unnecessarily.
Yeah,
I felt he came out quite vindicated of the songwriting side of things. Yeah, so it is fun that they're just naming jams. Yeah, and who is doing it?
So. Ringo arrives, and it's a lovely moment. Again, there's some of this in the original Let It Be movie, but it's always good to see. They play the boogie-woogie. Again, it's been given a credit to Lennon McCartney Starkey, and it's called I Bought a Piano the Other Day. But it's them just pissing around, isn't it, really?
Yeah. And again, like, you know, obviously we know Lennon's not there, but interesting that McCartney can't just then have McCartney Starkey. Lennon still... So they literally are bonded, even when it's a collaboration with someone else, which is... So I guess, was that a contract thing that they'd signed and that was the agreement?
It's got to be, hasn't it? Yeah.
Must be.
And I think it's also... Yeah, because all the estates are involved as well.
Yeah.
Then you've got a brief cameo... by sound recordist Peter Sutton, and Paul plays Glyn Johns, who's the absolute peacock throughout all of this in his wonderful outfits. The song he wrote for Peter and Gordon, Woman, which he actually released under a pseudonym, Bernard Webb, because he wanted to see if he could actually write a song without relying on the name Lennon McCartney.
Right.
But it's a beautiful thing to see, because it is a really good song.
I've never heard the actual song. That was the first time that I've heard, and he just, you know, he talks about how, what a big chord and stuff, and it sort of passed me by, actually, when he was playing it, but I listened to it again this morning, and yeah, it is really stunning. Did it become a hit for the two of them? No, it didn't. No, right, okay.
One of their worst-selling singles.
So were Peter and Gordon, who I've never heard of, were they a chart-topping act?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Really? I mean, wow. Paul,
Jane Asher was Peter's sister, Peter Asher, so they were really close.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I know who that is now. Okay.
Yeah, so they did write a lot of songs for them.
Oh, and it didn't do anything?
No.
Wow. And was this in this period as well, or was this a few years back?
This was 66. Okay.
Right.
So then we're back to Paul Bond, who I love. I just think he's me. That's exactly what I'd be like. And he's still fascinating about Paul's songwriting. He's going, do you write your songs at the piano or the guitar? It's whatever I'm around, you know. He's very cool about it. And then he just said, actually, yeah, I just had this one this morning, and it's straight out of Hollywood, backseat of my car.
Yeah, it's incredible. Like, again, like, as well as my point earlier about seeing how much McCartney, you know, that Lennon really didn't need to be there for many of the songs, but just what an insight into the songwriting sort of channeling of Paul McCartney that he can just create. And that was, I mean, right there from then, we had the first whole section of that song. Nothing really gets changed. We get up to the point where he then goes into the bigger, fast beat of the song, or the double-timed piano playing. And, it's just... It honestly felt like, well, this is a privilege to be sitting, not even in the room, just on the other side of the camera watching this. It's just unbelievable capturing of historical moments as a Beatles fan, obviously, and it's on the bigger...
Yeah.
You know, backseat of my car in the bigger scheme of things is not, you know, humongous historically. But for us, whew, what a hot moment.
We now know it was conceived on the evening of Monday the 13th, January 1969.
Yes.
As fact.
Yes, you know? Exactly.
Documented. I love all that.
Yeah. I can't remember when he's playing it in the moment, does it come up with a Lennon McCartney credit underneath?
I don't think so, no.
See,
no.
That's cheeky. I know I've been giving Lennon shit for it, but, you know, he was bound at the hip at this point. I feel that's a bit unfair.
But then it would have been on an album by Paul and Linda McCartney in 1971, suddenly having a Lennon McCartney song. I don't think he's going to agree to that.
I think Wings should have been called Lennon/Wings. That's all I'm saying. I think everything needed Lennon/ in front of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I am just a sort of interesting way that I first saw Get Back. I went to a screening of it, very luckily.
You went?
Yeah, my friend Anna got given tickets. I think her mum knew some people at Apple. And I was going, and then Anna had to pull out. But fortunately, someone else at QI, the guy who runs it, John Lloyd, was going as well. So I met up with John before we went in, and we thought we're going to a screening, you know? When you work in this kind of TV industry, you get invited to screening sometimes, and you go in, there's six journalists sitting there, and you watch, you know, Jojo Rabbit, I think was the last one I went to. So I thought, okay, this will be great fun. Walk in, and I think we clicked as we got to the front door, because we saw Noel Gallagher standing there, that we were, in fact, not at a screening, but the premiere. And so, what a night. I mean, it's worth just pumping in some information from that for a second. And in fact, I have, which I can play to you if you want. I snuck my camera out because just at the beginning, before the screening went on, Paul McCartney came out and gave a speech at the top of the screening. And I don't think anyone else recorded it. I haven't seen it anywhere else online. And, you know, he doesn't say anything, you know, which is different to what he's been saying in interviews. But I can play that in if you'd like to hear it in a bit. It was an amazing evening for a few reasons. You were walking around and there were all these people who were obviously big fans. So you had everyone from, like, as I say, Noel Gallagher to Mick Hucknall, and Elvis Costello was there, and all these like legendary names. But there was this beautiful moment, and as I say, Paul McCartney was there, and that was pretty extraordinary, because Paul did this speech and then came and sat down and sat in the cinema where there was about 200 of us, I would say. And you're sitting there watching it for the first time with Paul, but also the screening obviously couldn't play the three-parter. So there was a sort of almost 45-minute introduction with Peter Jackson going, hello, wish I could be there tonight, but I can't. But I've cut this together to show you what you're going to be experiencing in the longer form. And then we're going to play a single day, a whole day for you to watch. And then that's what the screening will be.
Okay.
So I almost wish to an extent, and I'm sure it will be released someday soon, this thing that Peter Jackson did, where it's sort of a talking head of him, and it comes back to then showing you clips from the movie, because he's so passionate, and it's so interesting him talking through the whole technical process of how they made the thing. And he opens it with this stunning moment, and I really wish that he just did this for the opening of the documentary as a whole. Do you remember there's that wonderful chat where they're all talking about how this documentary is being filmed, in what grading and in what quality?
Yeah.
And they all seem to have really good technical knowledge about, no, you should be filming it, and, oh, why don't you do it in that? And they're all saying their thing, and then it gets to Paul, and he's saying, I think you should do it like this, and because it would make more sense, you know. And they're talking about, in cinemas, this would be... And as they're having the chat, we're seeing it as we saw it in the Let It Be movie, grainy and horrible. And as they're having the chat, it slowly gets bigger and widescreen and clearer to what Peter Jackson has made it. And the audience just go, whoa, collectively. Yeah. Collective, whoa! I mean, it really felt like this extraordinary CGI moment. And so that was amazing. The whole screening then was great. And there was a really fun thing, which was they played all of the rooftop terrace as the concert, as they do in the documentary itself. But we got to see it in the cinema as one whole piece. And after every single song, there were 200 people applauding the song, which must have been the first time that Paul's ever been in a room watching that gig and actually finally getting the audience applause for that gig, which he never would have got at the time. So that was really special. And then for some reason, they include the credits at the end. Like, Peter Jackson just plays out the whole credits of, I guess, what was part three. And this was the most special bit, because every name that came up, be it for as a thanks or a name check or, like, you know, Glyn Johns and Giles Martin, clearly every single one of them, including their families, were in the audience, and they all got their big moment where you'd hear a pocket of the crowd go, yeah! You know, it was so wonderful. Like, Derek Taylor's name came up, and you'd hear this, wah, wah, and it turns out all of Derek Taylor's family were there, you know, to represent him, and Glyn Johns was there, and so when his name comes up, that's great, so he gets a big applause. And that was really special. That was amazingly special. You know, George Harrison in the credit, and Danny Harrison's there in the crowd, and all the other Harrisons and cousins and so on, and Ringo's family were all there. And so you were just watching, you realize you're in a room of family, this big Beatles family that's been going for 50, 60 years, however long. It was such a touching moment and a real privilege to have been able to witness that warmth in the room. Really, really special.
Wow. Thanks for sharing that.
It was a spectacular night, and we very luckily got to go to the after party, which was even more special because it went till about 1 a.m. It was in this small club, and again, I was like a real imposter going in there. I don't know how I managed to slip in. It was because I was with John Lloyd, and he knows the Apple guys really well. And yeah, so spent an hour chatting with Glyn Johns afterwards, who I happen to have met once before. He was on a radio show that I produced or co-created. I'd left it, but I went back to watch him do an episode of it, and I got to meet him once before. The nicest guy, and he was getting pummeled that night just because he had so many family members of, like, people that he worked with back in the day coming up to him and trying to... Like, you got to meet our great grandkids, and he was just like, whoa, like, this is wonderful, but wow, this is just too much. It's like a crazy family reunion. Paul was there till, you know, 1 a.m. just chatting to everyone, being Paul. I mean, he must have been in his element, really. But wild night. Wild, wild night.
Amazing. Can we hear that intro?
Do you want to hear it? Yeah. Let me bring it up on my... So, you know, what a moment when suddenly there's someone very special here tonight, Paul McCartney, and he comes out, and here we go.
Wow. Big swing. Okay. So I did want to say a couple of words. When Peter Jackson first said he was going to do this film, I said to him confidentially, I said, because it was surrounded for me by the memories of the Beatles breakup. So I thought, I can't see how it's going to work. Anyway, he started sending me clips, and it was like, was it a laugh? And then there was something else that was like funny. And it showed us working together and laughing together and having a good time together. And I'd forgotten that because the whole of the Beatles thing had kind of overpowered it. Anyway, so I was so happy, you know, that this is the way it turned out. And so anyway, thanks very much to Peter for doing a fantastic job and, you know, remastering the film, and Giles for doing all the sound and stuff. And all the people who worked on it, thank you very much for doing that, because I think you've done a great job. To say so, I do think it now shows how we were in the studios and on the roof. And for me, it's lovely because it brings back to me my mates, my fallen heroes, you know, who aren't here. And it's great to see them on the film, to be able to study them. Because normally I'm just singing, and I can't, you know, really study them. But with this, I can. So fabulous for me. I love it. I love Peter. I love all the people involved. I love the Beatles. Great group. So thank you very much. Enjoy the show. Thank you.
Yeah. Wow.
He's such a fanboy.
He is.
I love it.
And he would have sat there just watching himself, yeah. You know, really happily, I'm hoping, because it was a magical day that they played. It was the one in the lead up to the concert. And it's when they're really, when John and Paul are staring at each other with intensity of love and jokes as they're doing their get back song practices and so on. And it's very cool. Very, very lucky to
awesome.
Been there for that night.
Oh, I love it. So, back to Twickenham.
Yeah.
And Ringo's messing around with the camera. There's quite an amusing bit where he films Michael Lindsay Hogg, and he's zooming the camera in and out.
Yeah, so cool. I mean, what a cool bit of direction from Peter Jackson that he was able to trace down. Not only, obviously, that was easy. That's a camera shot, but I love it when you see Linda McCartney coming in various days, taking a photo, and then he's found that photo, and then we get to see that photo. So any bit of documentation that has been done in that period, it's they've gone out and found those bits and brought them in, and God, it's good. No criticism.
There's a moment where Ringo starts filming Paul, who's again sort of messing around. It's another song called Song of Love, apparently, another Lennon McCartney original.
Mm.
But what I love about it is that Paul sort of looks and he sees Ringo's behind the camera. So when he's smiling, we're feeling what it's like for Ringo. Because when Paul smiles at Ringo, it's different to how he smiles for publicity shots.
Absolutely.
And it's like a real Paul smile to a friend. And we're Ringo for a few seconds.
Yeah. It's such, I mean, isn't that, and Ringo really, you have that comment from Linda in one of these days around this period where she just says, you know, I feel most comfortable around Ringo, and you really feel that even in the documentary. You just feel like this is an unobtrusive guy. We get to see later in the documentary when he comes in with Octopus's Garden, and I found that a very interesting scene in that you kind of see him go, this is my song, here are the kind of quite, you know, childish lyrics, and then he goes, that's all I've got, and everyone laughs, but George isn't. George is there studying it, and he comes over and let's do that again. And very similar to what you're saying about that smile, I feel like that love is reciprocated from the others who are just like, no matter what you do, we want to be a part of it and help you. And you can see why his subsequent career with his solo albums was able to attract so many people who just wanted to be a part of his world, because just a joyous man, just wonderful.
Yeah, he is. John and Yoko finally arrived. They've been filming an interview for Canadian TV.
Yeah.
And then I love this moment because basically they've got to get out soon. They're running out of time. George has quit. And they've got to obviously leave before the Magic Christian filming begins. And then you see all the sets arrive.
Yes.
Just as a little reminder, lads, you are seriously running out of time.
Yeah. Right? But quite funny as well that it's Ringo's sideline gig, you know, like we've got to get out of here because I've got a movie that I need to make, you know.
Yeah.
It's a and you never get any sense that the movie is in any way dominating his thinking. You know, no one really asks about it except for when the guy who runs Twickenham has a big chat with Ringo about it. But you never get the sense that he's like got the script out. You know, even when the script is mentioned, going, "Oh yeah, they're punching it up," he's like, "Oh okay, does it need it? Sure, okay, whatever." He doesn't. There was this whole thing where they need to get out of there. My thought was, oh, that means that Ringo's going to be starting on the film soon, but you just get no sense that he's got any pressure in his life in that direction. He's just, put me wherever, I'll just be Ringo, it's fine.
Yeah. And then we've got, you were saying earlier about how without George there, there's no focus, they're just rambling on, and then they decide, Paul and Ringo, they want to make a silent movie. And Mal would play the policeman gone wrong.
Yeah.
And Ringo's the teacher who goes to see him. All this strange stuff. And then Paul decides to be hoisted up the scaffolding by Ringo.
I think that bit, though, I used to be in a band when I was in school, when it was like the first band I was ever in, it was at school. And we used to do our rehearsals in a factory that was sort of run by the singer in our group. His parents ran it, and so it was a light. They like made lighting fixtures and stuff, and so it was this really cool warehouse. And that was the best bit about stopping in between songs and like climbing the scaffolding and doing. So I really enjoyed seeing that because I just that reminded me of what it is like being in a band when there's downtime. You look at the weird things around you, and you dare each other to do stuff. And they're doing it at the height of. Of their careers, yeah. Really. I really love that moment for that reason.
Yeah.
Silliness.
So we've cut to Roadie Kevin Harrington, who we're getting a lot of love for doing these. Yoko, John, Ringo and Paul. And John and Paul are really playing up to the camera. I love the fact that throughout all of this, John is still wearing the same clothes for continuity, which by now must absolutely reek.
Yeah, incredible. Absolutely incredible.
But John is brilliant. His wit here is just another level, isn't it?
It's
fantastic.
It's incredible, and it's so honed and tight, and you can see how I always wondered about those in Our Right, in His Own Right, and Spaniard in the Works. You know, those stories are so bizarre and his connections are so weird, and sometimes I thought, are you just deliberately misspelling a word as you're typing it on the page in order to give it a different meaning? But you watch him in this scene doing it live, he's finding the other pronunciation or the other choice of word that would sit in place of, you know, he says like tumble a star or something about Ringo, and for some reason I don't know why, it's just the quickness in which he does it and the ease in which he does it, you can see that this is a guy whose mind is operating at such an interesting pace. He does talk about the fact that he's been up all night and he's high, and he's and that's a really uncomfortable moment for Paul, who actually gives a David Brent look to the camera, kind of, you know, sort of as in like he's sussing out if it's still on, like he's suddenly aware, hang on a second, what are you doing here? So I don't know if we're seeing John still in this kind of euphoric high state, like the aftermath of it, but God, it's funny. And the whole thing about the Boy Scouts with masturbation and I love Yoko being like, why are they all laughing? What's going on?
Yeah.
Because you're just saying weird shit right now.
Yeah.
But yeah, I felt like we just, and his intensity of staring at the camera, John, during that whole period. Ah,
yeah.
It's wonderful. Yeah. I feel like I've said wonderful a lot in this episode so far, but it's I can't stop saying it.
But it is. But he is, when he stares at the camera, he's got a stare on him. You can see why so many people were frightened of him. Imagine him as a teenage teddy boy.
Yeah.
When he stares at you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Talking of awkward, Peter Sellers arrives. He's obviously in Magic Christian with Ringo.
Yes.
I do actually love the bit where he first comes in and he strokes Ringo's hair and Ringo goes to get him a chair. And then it just gets a bit awkward.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't. So I'm a big fan of Sellers, and I've watched most of his movies, I would say, and read most of the biographies on him. So when he enters the room, I instinctively went, well, this is gonna suck, because he, by all accounts, was a very odd human without a personality, and I think he suddenly sat down with a triad of personalities that are so intertwined. Even though Ringo doesn't really say anything, they were talking their own language, and Sellers was like, I think Sellers was going, I'm clearly, am I the most famous person sitting in this situation? And what do I, what is my purpose here in this conversation? I know the cameras are on. I have nothing to say. Do I even want to say anything? I couldn't work out, had they met each other before this point, had John met Sellers, because I know he was a huge fan, but I just couldn't tell. They were so casual at the hello.
Ringo had, but they'd been given an award before, but it was by video.
Right.
So they kind of crossed paths, but no, because he was saying it's lovely to meet you guys. So I think it was only Ringo, as far as I know. I don't think he met the others.
Yeah. So, and John is still in his, I mean, possibly that's what it is that John is still slightly high. He's just, or that's how his mood was on the day, but he feels it, where he's just sort of going, he's talking slightly in code. But Paul, who you'd figure would do his best to help Sellers out of an awkward patch, doesn't do anything to help. He just kind of adds to it in a way.
He does.
Which is a bit.
So they keep calling him Pete. Right, Pete. Yeah. what it really reminds me of, I think, the way John's, I think you're right about what you're saying, because he said he was up most of the night. You can't imagine how much he'd taken. But with this, it really reminds me of the footage of John and Bob Dylan, who was another, you know, John said millions of times how important the Goon Show was for him.
Mm.
And Peter Sellers was a hero. And the same with Bob Dylan. And in 1966, there's that footage where they're in the back of the car. Dylan's really off his head. And John is the worst person you could have in the car with you, because he's just trying to freak him. Oh, watch out for the ghosts, Dylan. You know?
Oh, is he? Right, I haven't seen that.
And he's really, he's got that similar kind of spikiness to Dylan that he has for Peter Sellers. So I wonder if it's a, I don't know what it is.
Yeah, I don't know. Because then I saw an interview a few days ago where Lennon is on a chat show with Chuck Berry, who is Lennon's idol. And he is, I actually felt like you saw Lennon trying to reach through to Chuck to sort of be, you're a hero. And Chuck not knowing what to do with that, because he was just like, I mean, Chuck seemed high as well. Like, he was just like, and I'm pretty sure he probably didn't do drugs. I think he was just like, yeah, man, I want to play some songs and that's when I'm alive. And but I think it's the first time where I've seen John fanboy over someone. And I haven't seen too many encounters. Like, I haven't seen the Dylan encounter, for example. But I think, what I mean is, he is capable of doing that. He is capable of going, God, I love you, because that's what he was doing to Chuck Berry in that interview.
Yeah. Ringo's still feeling poorly. Paul suggested if they keep filming, they might get footage of a Beatle being sick.
Yes.
Which is lovely. And then John tells them he was late. As you say, he was still recovering. And the way he describes it, I'm just mistreating my body. I was up late, I was all sort of stoned and high and watching films. And like you say, Paul looks so uncomfortable, doesn't he, when he's looking at the camera. But and then John's very much, well, no, it's not, if I say I'm going to come in at 10, I will come in at 10. It seems to be okay. But then we're forgetting that George still isn't.
Yeah. It's an interesting insight into Lennon generally, this whole thing for me. Lennon's always branded as the fiery character who you imagine always had something to say, always, according to a lot of the biogs, you know, confrontational, would never stand down. And I found him being exceedingly patient in a lot of the conversations that would happen without needing to say something necessarily. And when he did, it was always a calm thing. And even that sentence, like, you know, I should come in at 10. I should, like, he's helping out there. He's not being like, well, fuck it, George isn't here. Like, what am I? You know, he's working in the direction of trying to make Paul feel like the ship is still on course. And I don't know, in all the years, that's just not the Lennon that I expected in day-to-day chat. That what an interesting thing for him to just be like, yeah, no, I should be better. I should want to. And they do have a bit of friction in the chat that subsequently happens here. But nothing direct. Like, there's nothing ever directly said, which is extraordinary.
You can read between the lines. I mean, if you just write it out, it just doesn't make sense. But when you hear them speaking to each other, you know, basically Paul's just saying, we need to sort ourselves out.
Yeah.
And we can't do this indefinitely. And John's kind of stating Beatles lyrics.
Yeah.
You know.
Which is bizarre. But, it takes a while to realize that that's what he's doing, or at least it
Well, when
for
I
me.
Touch you, I feel happy inside. I can't hide, I can't hide. Ask me why, I'll say I love you.
Yeah. So, okay, so we've got, and when I touch you, so we've got that. What's and ask me why, and I'll say I love you. I can't work out what that is.
That is ask, that's this song, Ask Me Why.
Oh, okay,
ask
right.
Ask me why, I'll say I love you.
Ah, okay.
Very strange.
Yeah, and Paul's trying to have a serious conversation while he's being quoted to.
But what he's actually asking for isn't that, it's not difficult, because he's saying, we just need a schedule.
Yeah.
We need to achieve something every day. And John and Yoko, oh, that's really hard. It's not.
Yeah.
Just write something, get Mal to write something down.
Yeah.
And do it.
I love that line he says, you need a serious program of work, not an aimless rambling among the canyons of your mind.
Yeah.
Is that from something? Or was that just Paul riffing there?
It's, that was...
Must be from
that,
something, right?
Bonzo song.
Was it? Okay. Cool. If that's the case, that's very cool. Yeah, and then they have this whole thing where he then says, Mal comes over and says, how many numbers will you be doing? And John says, I'm planning on 11. And Paul, that's the line where I heard the annoyance. It's 12 to 14, Mal. Like, it's a very stern, no, that's what's happening. Can I just quickly just hold us up for a second and just say Mal, who I was not aware of as a character, is the most wonderful, gentle giant throughout the whole of this documentary. Just a beautiful presence. What an energy. What a... You can... Like, congrats to the Beatles for surrounding themselves with so many loving people. It really comes out as the supporting cast of this movie. It's just really wonderful. And I was horrified to read how his life ended. I was thinking, oh, I hope he's someone that... you know, might have even have been there on the night of the premiere, but I just didn't know to look out for him.
Mm.
Gunned down by police, only less than a decade after this was filmed in L.A.
Oh,
because
that's incredibly sad.
Because he was just very high and he had an air gun that he refused to put down. And he must have looked like a giant to the L.A. police. Was it L.A. or wherever it was in America? He must have looked like a giant. And they didn't need to kill him. So it wasn't like he was doing anything chaotic. I mean, he should have put down the gun, obviously, if police are telling you to put down a gun. But, it was so sad to read about how his life played out. Because he's such a nice guy.
Yes.
And he obviously makes them all so happy. Just his look.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's what I love about the Beatles in a circle. Because there's so many of them, especially doing this, who are so popular. I mean, George Martin. There's a lot of love from the female listeners for George Martin in this film, by the way.
Mm.
But also Glyn Johns. But the reason we like them is because the Beatles, that's their close inner circle of friends. We're going to like, you know, if we like the characters of John, Paul, George and Ringo, chances are we're going to be drawn to the same people that they like. For the same reason that they are. It's very like a family thing, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. My friend Anna, who got the invite to go to the screening, because she had to miss it, she then got given tickets to a subsequent screening, which happened like a week and a half later. And in the crowd for her night were the two police officers who shut down the gig and are in the reception. One of the great comedy scenes, I think, in any documentary that we'll ever see. But so even them have been... And one of them was Princess Diana's personal bodyguard for years and years, Jeff Lloyd was telling me, who I'm sure will be doing one of these. Yeah, he went on to do that. But so they were there on the night. So even they are family in a weird way now. You know, anyone who's touched part of this history becomes such a... Yeah, family member.
Yeah. When you were saying about when they were talking to Mal, and there's a bit of a power thing going on here, because, like you say, John's saying, I'm planning 11. Paul, it's 12 to 14, Mal. And then John, it's a choice of six, and it's kind of like CEO tennis.
Mm.
They're both sort of vying for the power in this. And then George Martin's joking about Ringo could just put on a really long drum break.
Yeah, yeah.
Michael Lindsay-Hogg. Mm. Been lots of discussions about him. I think he's brilliant.
Yeah.
But he's saying, he sounds really despondent here. He's saying the documentary's grinding to a halt. And John's like, let's take it off. They're kind of taking the piss as this, everything's collapsing around Michael Lindsay-Hogg.
But that, I mean, John and Paul were spot on. You caught the Beatles' breakup on camera, and you think your documentary's not working? I guess he had a different idea that he couldn't get his head away from, which we all know because he spends the whole time trying to get them overseas to do the gig. So he's got a vision that he's obsessed with, and possibly wasn't quite aware of the magnitude of what he was capturing on camera. And maybe because documentaries, I would love to see the period of documentaries in the late 60s, early 70s, of whether or not the deconstruction of something as opposed to a real, like, I just want the sound bites that make it a fantasy kind of thing. I don't know what it was like, whether or not that was in the world of documentary language at that point. But I would have gone home going, you're not going to believe what I got on camera today. George Harrison quitting the Beatles. And they're now just sitting going, what do we do? Like, well, that's an extraordinary thing to have captured. But again, the other thing is, were they, you know, that's us talking all these years later. And we know that the legacy has endured and that they've become this big, almost mythological thing. You know, was at the time, where were they? Were they still the biggest band in the world? Were they still loved? Were they struggling with their identity as a band in the public? I don't know.
Don't think so, but what John Bradley pointed out, he did Day One, and it was something really you don't think of until afterwards, but when they're doing On the Rooftop gig and they're doing the Vox Pops, and the guy's saying, oh, do you know who this is? Oh, I'm not sure. It's the Beatles. And he was saying, if that was Hear Me Boy, what? It's the Beatles?
Yeah.
And most of them are just like, oh, right, oh, okay. And so, and then they wander off and do whatever they're doing.
Yeah.
So there's not that reverence, I think, that we have today. I think they were just the biggest band at the time.
Yeah.
And obviously, as the years have gone by, they've become the stuff of legends.
Exactly. So that's, it's so hard to know where to place them as when they, you know, like there was that whole thing that I think someone said once about really when John died, when he was murdered, that was the moment when the Beatles kind of had a second wave of huge, you know, it could have been, I can't remember who said this to me, and they must have been wrong in their saying it. They were like, you know, the Beatles could have just become another band, you know, like, but John's death is what elevated them into kind of like this huge status. I don't believe that, but I wonder if there were periods where they were like, you know, the White Album, did it hit? Was that a big hit, the White Album? Or did that kind of not have the record sale? So they always had, they were always at the top, were they? Sorry, I should know this.
Oh, yes.
I should know this, but I'm just, I
but
don't
forget, around this time, you've got things like Floyd and Zeppelin.
Yeah.
And Deep Purple. So rock's going in a different way, Hendrix, all this kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I think it was the first time really in their career they'd had serious challenges. It's not like you're sort of Billy J. Kramer and the Dakotas and Jerry and the Pacemakers kind of thing. There was a lot of big bands coming up alongside them, but they were still always number one even then. So
yeah, okay, well that's good to know.
Then we got this again, more sort of Spaniard in the works. John does this, and he's again staring to the camera, and he does that. Once upon a tarmac, there lived a small baggage who'd suffered incredible distortion on his right leg. He took it to all the doctors, and they said, and he just shakes his head, no. But one day, and he nods, and then happy ever after. And it's straight out of the mouth of Bidney, to quote John.
It's incredible.
From nowhere.
Yeah. And was that, you know, is that something he wrote at home that he's reciting an old memory, or was that just live in the moment?
No, I think that's just coming out, isn't it?
It's just, so he was, so to the point I was making before, that was just, you could have just transcribed that, put that into Spaniard, and he had made all the wrong words, or the different words, in place of a right word. There, they were there. I don't necessarily think that's good, by the way. Like, I was rereading a lot of those books, those two books specifically, and Skywriting. It's so hard to read. It's so...
Oh, yeah.
And there's a lot of, like, questionable ideas from John that, you know, were not good. And so I'm impressed by his ability to do that in the moment. But I don't know what use it is necessarily. Like, I much prefer Grapefruit by Yoko. I can get my head round the humor and the sort of the bizarreness of putting your head in a different place with a look at the sky and do 700 flips in your head or whatever stuff that she writes. That kind of speaks to me. But John's writing, it's just a bit odd. but he could do it out loud and on the spot. So 10 points.
Yeah. Michael Lindsay-Hogg, again, he's panicking. He just wants to know what's going to happen. What are we doing? And John says, well, it all rests now on when we see. And then Paul interrupts, stop filming. And again, we've mentioned it before, the ethics. They keep recording the audio.
Mm.
So we get to hear at least. George is in Liverpool. So they decide tomorrow to go and see him.
Yeah, I think that's... And I actually was quite annoyed by the ethics in that I don't think they should have turned the cameras off. So I'm glad that we got those extra snippets. like when George quits and they say, turn it off. And they do.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? Just point the camera down. Do what Michael Moore would do. Just say it's off. Do what any BBC reporter now does out in the field when they're told to turn the camera off by the police. Face it to the ground, say it's off, and record history. What are you doing? Every single time, turn it off. Yep, sorry. Sorry. Didn't want to intrude on this obviously intrusive documentary that we're meant to be making anyway. So the fact that we lost those moments because they didn't have the guts to keep it going. And otherwise, we wouldn't have got that amazing conversation where the microphones were hidden in the pot plant in the previous day 8 or 7, where Lennon comes back in and they sit in a cafe without the cameras. I mean, that's espionage shit with the Beatles. And thank God we got it. And once again, John Lennon, absolutely just not coming across as a dick to me. Like, he's having a real conversation with his pal about a serious situation. He's saying a few firm points, but he's never the fiery Lennon that I thought we'd all been told that he was. It was considered... Yeah. I might need to listen to it again, but that's my memory of it from one viewing. I thought, that was still measured. That was still not a bad conversation. Mm-hmm. But that's what I want. Fucking microphones everywhere. Get him in the toilet. Get him in... That's what we're here for. Can you turn it off? Yeah, sure. Turn it off. Do it. I'd fire. I'd so be Michael. If I was Michael, I'd fire whoever turned off. I'd be at the end of the day, go, did you turn it off when they said to? Yeah, you're fired. What are you doing?
Imagine if you'd made this, Blimey.
Just, it would have been, gold.
Yeah, so the next day, Wednesday the 15th, they all do go and meet George, and it's a good meeting.
Yep.
And basically, the plan is now change the direction of the project, abandon the TV special, and they're going to reconvene at Apple Basement Studio in Savile Row on the Monday.
Yes.
And record some songs. However, this is the studio that's been built by Magic Alex.
Talk to me about Magic Alex quickly, because if he does appear in it, he doesn't make a sort of big scene-stopping moment. He probably is just peripheral. But who was he? He was just a really interesting designer of instruments and collector of instruments? Is that who he was?
He was Alexis Mardis. He was basically a con man. Who managed to infiltrate his way into Apple. He became head of Apple Electronics. And in all the time he was there, he never actually invented anything.
Okay.
He'd often bring things in that had been patented that weren't his, claiming that he could do something like that.
Mm.
But he'd planned to do all the studio, which, as we find out, was just complete chaos. It was unworkable.
Yeah.
But he was a guru at the time. He was there with Maharishi. It was him that told John the Maharishi might have been doing something untoward, which is why they quit.
Okay.
Yeah, difficult to warm to for me.
Okay. And was he... How many albums would his sort of influence of his presence have been on? Is it just this one where he starts getting involved with setting up a studio for them?
Yeah, well, ultimately...
And it doesn't happen anyway. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So nothing, he didn't do anything.
Okay, so he was Apple, but he didn't quite, make it into the...
Yeah.
Because it's interesting, the people who appear in this who kind of don't really have, when it comes to the records, much more of a footprint with the Beatles, even in their solo careers, like Glyn, for example, like they clearly love him so much and they really respect his decision-making, even when it comes to suggestions about what do you think about this sort of like choice of songwriting or arrangement within the song. They go to him as much as they go to George Martin, really, in terms of asking for opinion and respecting the opinion. And you look into Glyn's subsequent career, and really, I think he worked on a Billy Preston album that came out after this, which was produced by George Harrison, the whole album, which I didn't realize. And then Red Rose Speedway, I think he was the engineer on for Wings, and but that's
and he quit.
And did he really? He quit during it, did he? Okay. Yeah. Wow. But that, yeah, like, what happened there? They, because they all, you know, would work with people who were connected in some respect. George Martin always came back in. Even Phil Spector would, even though he cocked up Let It Be, he's there on All Things Must Pass and Lennon stuff. Yeah, it's just Glyn.
I think
Glyn
John,
disappears.
John and George, because both their, you know, the 1970 albums are heavily with Phil Spector, and then they just headed off in their own directions. Paul experimented with hundreds of producers.
Did he? Okay, right.
And Ringo didn't really. Well, it was 73 before he made a proper album.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think they just moved on.
Yeah, fair
and
enough.
I think Glyn had moved on because he was doing amazing albums by then.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
he probably didn't need them.
Yeah, busy guy, but obviously he loves them so much. At the same time, you'd think, wow. And despite George quitting, this is actually a really, from what you can see of the recordings, it's quite a lovely process. The whole thing is that one day that happens later on where Heather McCartney comes in and spends the whole day basically jumping in the way of all the Beatles. And again, they never lose their cool. They're really sweet with her. You know, it looked like a fun place to be, to me.
Yeah. So we're on the Thursday, the 16th of January, which is day 10. I'm going to do this as part of this because there's not much really happens, but it's worth talking about.
Mm.
So there's plans to reconvene after the weekend at Apple Studios. So all the equipment in Twickenham is being dismantled. And Mal wearing a lovely suit. It's not the sort of thing you wear when dismantling drum kits.
Very Beatles suit, isn't it? He looks early Fab Four kind of look about it.
He does. And then Glyn John's, again, looking every inch the rock star. Paul decides, oh, I'm just going to nip in and record a demo of Oh Darling.
Amazing.
And the song's more or less done.
Yeah. Yeah, once again, he just, is able to channel and nail immediately a song. And then there's Lennon's name up against it. Lennon McCartney.
Yeah.
Lennon putting in the hard shift there with Oh Darling. That's bullshit, isn't it? Paul's been telling us this whole time, but he's right. It's bullshit. This whole collaboration thing. Sure, the early days, but come on.
Yeah.
It's hilarious.
And then, well, hey, for the first time for days, we see George puffing away on a ciggy.
Yeah.
And he's arrived to meet up with Glyn Johns to head off to examine what Magic Alex's studio setup is like at Apple. And there's some lovely bit of footage here from the car, and you see a busker.
Yeah.
Maybe it's because I'm a Londoner on the accordion, and you're transformed back into the 60s.
What does it say as well? The busker, it's almost for a charity, for like an army thing.
Oh, yeah,
thing,
partly blind.
Partly blind, but is he wearing like military-esque outfits?
Yeah.
Maybe I made that up, but yeah. It was. You're right. It's a really lovely shot of them going across all those London shots.
But it is. Yeah, he's holding that badge, partly blind, and then again, there's that cartoon John did in his book with the busker holding up the sign. I can see quite clearly.
Oh, as in one of the two that he did.
Yeah,
that's cool. Good spot. Well done.
So many coincidences.
Do you think that's a coincidence, or do you think that he would have seen that guy and done that?
Oh, no, because he did that years ago.
Oh,
he did that when he was a teenager.
Got it. Okay.
It's just pure coincidence, So George and Glyn, they arrive at Savile Row to discover the studio's not quite as magic as they were expecting. And when they test equipment, basically all they're getting is distortion and hiss. So Glyn contacts George Martin, and basically EMI have to get portable recording equipment over. They spend the weekend with George, Dave Davis, Keith Slaughter, and the team from Abbey Road, the whole weekend installing the equipment.
Mm.
And basically they create an 8-track desk by linking two portable 4-track mixing consoles together and feeding in the audio. They're still using George Harrison's 8-track.
It's amazing. How could they not get access to all this stuff as the Beatles at this point? Because are we at the beginning of this technology, and it's, you know, is it?
Well, yeah.
Right.
Because they mentioned before about, why can't we get an 8-track? The Beach Boys have got one.
Yeah.
And they were like, well, they're in America. So the technology was still being developed in the UK.
Wow.
It's still brand new. And they never, you know, you would have thought, well, the Beatles, they'll have it first.
Yeah.
But they didn't.
So, but George does have an 8-track.
George Harrison, yeah.
Yeah. So why didn't they just use that? Why are they using two other 4-tracks? And then,
oh, they're the mixing consoles, the two 4-track mixing consoles.
Got it. Okay,
going to George's 8-track studio to actually record it.
Yeah, I mean, isn't it interesting in its own right as well that they are the biggest band in the world. You want the best studio in the world. Clearly, they can't get access to Abbey Road because something must be recorded in there at that point. Or they just, they for some reason, decided we just have no interest at the moment of going back in there. So with time against them and needing to record certain songs, they decide to set up over a weekend a studio in the basement of a building that they're in. Like, that's pretty, it's pretty bold.
Yeah.
It's cool.
I also love the fact that it was right. George was on strike. He hadn't quit because first thing he does is, well, here's my studio. Use that.
Yes.
And he's donating his own recording equipment.
Yeah.
I don't think he really meant it.
Or you have to, you know, bring flowers when you come back. He did strop out. You got to make a pretty big gesture to suggest I'm actually really back. Have my whole studio is a pretty nice way of saying sorry about the whole quitting.
So, Dan Schreiber, thank you so much. If you were Michael Lindsay Hogg at this point, George has returned.
Yeah.
They've set up at Savile Row. What would you be thinking about the future of your project?
Oh, well, I'd be thinking this. Okay, great. We're going to get an ending to this somehow with them back together. But I've got this extraordinary moment. We got it right, guys. You kept the cameras rolling after he asked them to be turned off. You got that right? Sorry. Okay, well, you're fired. That would have been the conversation that I had. But I think, yeah, I mean, I have a lot of questions about him generally. I don't know, when this movie went out, was it edited by him? And was it the piece that he decided to release? And what's his legacy? And I've heard nothing of him in the whole Get Back release. You know, is he... Because in the way that we're all talking about how history is being rewritten, about the fun that they had, the connection that they had, what we're effectively saying is, Michael, you told us a lie. You edited together an impression of history that has been there now for 40-odd years that said that they didn't like each other and that it was a miserable experience. Like, you made that decision. And now he's watching all of us go, hang on, this is... So I don't know what's he had to say about this whole thing. He wasn't in the room for the premiere. You know, the police were... But he wasn't for the screenings.
What I would say in his defense is that he made the film, because bear in mind it sort of sat on the shelf for a while after it was finished, and none of the Beatles could face looking at it. He probably couldn't face looking at it. So I think it's, from his perspective, Let It Be as a movie is a document of Michael Lindsay Hogg's perspective of what goes on.
Yeah.
Because he's now part of the film that we're watching now.
Yeah.
As are Mal and Kevin Harrington and all these different people, Glyn, who weren't really there. They were just sort of vaguely appeared in the background. In the, from his perspective, I completely understand why he would come out the other end and thinking, right, I remember this bit. Mm. Oh, bloody hell. Because for him, George quitting at the time, I guess, is not a brilliant bit of footage. It's, oh, shit, how am I going to finish this? Because he's still got in his mind that they're doing this show in Tripoli with the Arabs and the torch lit, you know, this kind of thing. He's got that in his head, I think.
You're right. And
so everything else.
Yeah, yeah. And also he's, as I was saying before, about wondering about what it was like with documentaries in the 70s. Actually, you've just nailed the main thing, which was he was not making a documentary with him in it. And that's largely what this is. He's part of the story about my film is falling apart. You know, he never would have thought, and he's in a lot of seminal scenes that he couldn't have then used. Otherwise, he would have had to have put himself into the thing. Just to clarify, I don't have any anger or beef with him over what he produced and released. I'm just curious that because of how it's now being expressed that it was something that was telling a distortion of the reality. That's kind of the impression that Peter Jackson and all of them, and Paul even in that, going, I forgot we were laughing the whole way through. It really made me reassess. Everyone's reassessing, and they're reassessing off a product that he released. That's the moment that we're bearing its new understanding off. It's that one thing that he produced.
Yeah.
So it must slightly suck that it's sort of like, oh, okay, you're telling me I did something that, you know, mistold the story. But I hope he's not, because he's such, like Mal, a lovely character the whole way through.
Yeah.
You really like him. He's really cocky at points, and it's such a fun addition to the whole thing.
Yeah. Dan Schreiber, Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. Thank you for having me. And I can't wait to hear the rest of this series as well as the bits before this. Because, again, we're so lucky. We're so lucky that Jackson went into the archives and gave us this. It's just been a fucking privilege to watch the four guys in a way that I don't think I've ever seen them before. So, yeah, kick ass. Hey! Hey! Hey!